SmackDown!
Today on Fanboy SmackDown, Episode 4, The New Dopes. Tony and Tony discuss George Lucas's Star Wars trilogies.
Okay, today we are going to be talking about Star Wars, specifically the Star Wars films, episodes 1 through 6. Want to start the conversation off with trying to decide how we're going to frame the discussion. Are we going to talk about episodes 1 through 3 first, or are we going to talk about it in that way chronologically, or are we going to talk about the order of release, 4 through 6, and then 1 through 3?
I think probably it depends on how you want to discuss it in terms of, do you want to talk about the story and how it progresses from 1 to 6, or do you want to talk about the more technical aspect of filming the 6 films and what kind of job Lucas actually did?
Well, I think having both of those discussions are really going to frame what the divide in fandom is. We have three movies, episodes 4 through 6, that are genre classics. They are masterpieces of the genre. More because the timing of them, I think, and I'll say it, more because the timing of them than the content. The story that is presented is an archetypical story. It's fairy tale. It's good guy versus bad guy with a rogue and a princess, and the good guy wins. It's especially episode 4 is very archetypical. It's very pat. It's not innovative in the story.
It's more innovative in terms of the world that it has, I think, up to that point, the most complete and immersive world that a science fiction film can create, I think, up to that point in filmmaking history. And I think that's the biggest strength of episode 4, that before that point, you could argue that certain other science fiction films, a lot was left to the imagination, whereas Star Wars really made a lot of breakthroughs technically in terms of how it was presented to the viewer.
Absolutely. The problem and really the meat of the discussion that I'd like to see us focusing on at this point is the difference between episodes 1 through 3 and the difference between episodes 4 through 6. Anybody that's going to be listening to this hopefully has at least seen one of the Star Wars films. But maybe we should give just a little bit of a recap.
Okay.
The story is basically the story of one person's life, Anakin Skywalker, from almost the beginning to the end. We have his story. Now, the way it was originally presented, it was not his story with episodes 4 through 6. It was Luke's story. But what we have is a young boy who's indoctrinated into a mystical order, the Jedi. Much later than tradition would have allowed, but there's a prophecy surrounding this character, this individual, that he will bring a balance to the Force, the mystical power that they hold over the universe. Now, anybody worth their salt would have realized that the Jedi were a strong force of good. Anything that's going to bring balance is going to cut the legs out from under the Jedi.
That's a good point.
It's going to take out the Jedi, or at least bring up the bad. Now I'm jumping ahead, but as the story progresses, the young boy Anakin Skywalker is slowly seduced by the dark side, or what the Jedi perceive the dark side to be. He is manipulated and pushed into actions and beliefs that are contradictory to the mystical order of the Jedi. Eventually leading to the death of his wife. He believes the death of his child that he believes are caused by the Jedi, thus thrusting him completely to the dark side, to the bad. He is now among the Sith. the antithesis of the Jedi. Through the process of it, he does bring balance to the Force. He slaughters the Jedi. They are gone. There are almost no Jedi left at the end. Then, flash forward 20-ish years, somewhere between 16 and 20 years, depending on which story you read. Now it's the story, supposedly, of a young farm boy who realizes that he's got a destiny that's far bigger and a history that's far bigger than he ever assumed. We get introduced to a Jedi, and when we're first introduced to him in Episode 4, we had no knowledge of Episodes 1 through 3. Taking it chronologically, though, we know this person to be the friend of his father.
Correct. Yeah.
If we take it chronologically, we know that this is Obi-Wan Kenobi, mentor and friend of his father. So we know that there's a very strong connection here. There's a very strong bond. And he's looking for some redemption in this. He's been trying to redeem himself in the loss of his friend and the push of his friend to the dark side, at least... If you want to psychoanalyze him a little bit, is a way you can look at the character. Continue on. They get a message from a princess. We know that there were two Skywalker children. We know that one of them was taken by.
When do we know
Bail
that?
Organa in Episode 3.
Okay, that's when we know three. That. But you're talking about in terms of viewing it from 1 to 6, not having seen Star Wars first. Episode 4 first, and what we know, what is inferred in Episode 4 when you're watching Episode 4 before the others.
Correct.
Versus having seen 1 through 3 and then watching 4.
Yeah, I'm just laying out the whole story.
Okay.
Just in case anybody's missed something along the way or hasn't seen it. The logical way to look at it now would be, you know, in 30 years... When somebody approaches the Star Wars, you know, 50th anniversary box set, and there's, you know, all 43 DVDs are probably actually one disc that it's all
right,
on by that
right.
time. Unless you know the story, your first instinct is going to be to pick up Episode 1 and watch from Episode 1 to Episode 6.
I think that's interesting, logically. But I don't know if that will be the case. I think it depends on how they treat 4 through 6 in terms of is the recuts that we have now, are those going to be the final cuts of 4 through 6?
That is a good question.
I would argue that if they're not the final cuts, then you're probably correct.
Right.
If these are the final cuts... I think everyone from here on out will still watch them in terms of 4 through 6 and then 1 through 3. Because I think it will be hard to deceive the knowing mind or the eye.
Right.
That, you know, chronologically, the last three films were made first. And
well, we'll get into that in a minute, but let's go ahead and finish the history here.
Okay.
Okay, so we've got a princess that we know is... the other Skywalker. If we've watched episodes 1 through 3, we know the order. We know that, or at least we have a really good assumption. I'm trying to remember now if they actually named the babies or not.
In 3. They do.
Okay. So we know that this is Leia. This is the sister of Luke. We know that if we watch them chronologically. Story-wise, chronologically. We have... a brother being asked to rescue a sister. Neither of them know their brother and sister. There's never any assumption of that. She has been told of someone who can help, Obi-Wan Kenobi. She's asking for his help. Obi-Wan realizing, you know, and now this is all retrospective from watching it originally, but Obi-Wan knows this is the sister. This is the brother. We're going in direct conflict with their father. I need to get him involved also. I need to make sure he stays involved in this series of events. These are the droids, one of which is the droid that was built by their father.
right.
You know, C-3PO. So we've got a lot of, for lack of a better word, incestual relationships, very intimately tied together relationships that are all being pulled together in Episode 4. They go out. They find a starship captain, a rogue, a thief, a smuggler. We have this very interesting character who he's the in some ways the jester, in some ways the thief, but he is also eventually he becomes love interest to the princess. Jumping ahead. So we get this group together. They go off in the process of trying to save the princess. They rescue her, but Obi-Wan comes into direct conflict with Darth Vader. Anakin Skywalker turned Darth Vader. Now we've skipped some points here. The Grand Moff Tarkin, the local governor of the system has elected to use this new base, this new battle station that they've built to destroy a planet, which just happens to be Leia's home planet. Interestingly enough, it's Tarkin's order that destroys the planet, not Vader's. It would be interesting to see, and if you really watch Episode 4, you get the sense that Vader is a soldier, that Tarkin is really the one in charge of the situation and the battle station.
I would argue that's true, but I don't necessarily... I never got the impression that Moff Tarkin was ultimately in control of all that much.
I think he had some control, and he pushed the limits of what he had control of as far as he could.
I think it was very much like, if you want to make a parallel to the first three episodes, I think it was very much the same way, the same relationship the Jedi Order had with the Senate, in that the Senate made the laws and executed everything, but ultimately the Jedi had much more power and could ultimately bring finality to any decision or indecision by the Senate. And I think it was the same way ultimately in the governorship in the Empire, that Moff Tarkin was, you know, making decisions, but there's no doubt that if Darth Vader wanted to have his way, he would have just had his way. And
sure.
He was largely an advisor position that Vader was in. Although I think if you listen to Lucas make his interviews, well, Vader isn't really that strong of a character. He's ultimately just the guy who goes and gets Satan's cigarettes. And I guess it's certainly true with respect to the Emperor, but I don't know. I still thought that Darth Vader was the most powerful character in Star Wars 4. You know?
He's definitely the most visually compelling. I mean, you look at that and you can't help but just get a little... Especially the first time you see it. The first time you see it on film, it's this moment of, holy crap, what are we looking at here?
I think the key moment in that film that lets us know who Vader is or what his place of power is when... One of the senators, or one of the... I don't know what his role is precisely, but he says, you know, your devotion to this ancient religion hasn't helped, you know, our situation at all, blah, blah, blah. He questions everything that Vader is, and then Vader shows that he can kill him just by thinking about it.
Sure.
That is a reminder to everyone who the real authority in the room is, even though his authority is really one of more of a just an advisory figure.
He's,
you know?
he's letting the local government think that they have a measure of control.
Right.
And when possible, he doesn't really get his hands dirty. If you want to take a look at it in terms of you know, politics, the Emperor really has plausible deniability in the order of the destruction of Alderaan, because it's Tarkin. It was Tarkin's order. It came out of Tarkin's mouth. Tarkin said, "Do it."
But what is the?
And Vader could have said, "Hey, he was in charge of the station. I was there in an advisory capacity. It was his call. you know, it's regardless of everything else, regardless of the power the empire had, they were still a political organization. They still had a measure of politics. And at
sure.
this point, they had just dissolved the Senate. That was one of the early points in the film, was that the Senate had just been dissolved.
Right.
So there was a really wild, I mean, consider any political situation where you're going from a democracy to a dictatorship, a military dictatorship. It was a big change that they were going through. It gave Palpatine a way out. But let's jump through this, get a little bit farther ahead. So we've had the destruction of Alderaan. It's gone. Obi-Wan Kenobi faces Vader. They fight. Basically, Obi-Wan gives in to him. He realizes the situation. He knows that he doesn't want to beat Vader. He doesn't want to kill his friend. He wants his friend back. He wants that person to come back. And I think he's got the sense that, one, the people that can stand up to him are his children. And the connection, once those people make that connection, they will be drawn together and a change will happen. And he's betting on good.
I think he just knows that he's not strong enough anymore to win that battle. And that the battle has to be thrust into Luke's hands in order for it to be won. I don't think he plans on Darth Vader being redeemed. I really don't think so. I think that, you know, in episode 6, to jump ahead, you know, Luke says, I think I can redeem him, and he says, he's more machine now than man, he's twisted and evil, and he just basically says, you're going to have to fight him. I think Luke is the only one that believes he can be redeemed.
But at the same time, look at everything that Obi-Wan Kenobi does through the course of those films. He is manipulating Luke in so many ways. It's said, you know, when through the course of episode 5, Luke finds out, in episode 5, Luke finds out that Vader is his father. He tells him flat out, I am your father. Together we can rule. What's interesting is that depending on how that's taken, I don't think that was necessarily an evil act. I think that was a loving act of a father. I think he really wanted to do the same thing for his son that he felt Palpatine did for him.
I don't know. I don't think that... Man, I would have to totally disagree with that. I think the father appeal is the ultimate emotional appeal by the devil character in the film, you know, in that film, which is episode 5, in which Darth Vader is much more assertive, powerful, evil, and destructive than in any other film
mm-hmm.
that he's in. And I think that's the ultimate emotional appeal. It's true, but that doesn't change the motivation of Darth Vader. Another interesting thing I think about the first film being 4 is that the Obi-Wan character, according to the commentary, I'm watching the director's commentary on the recut, and Obi-Wan wasn't necessarily supposed to die in 4, except that Lucas realized halfway through the shooting that it doesn't make any sense for the youths in the picture to not be handed over the torch, and that Obi-Wan should be in a more, you know, celestial, you know, spiritual advisory position. So he has to have a conversation with, what's the actor's name, Alec Guinness, about mm-hmm. this, and Alec Guinness is very disappointed that he doesn't live till the end of the film and continue fighting and have this big role. But Lucas convinces him that it's necessary plot-wise for him to die. So that kind of changes, perhaps, the way it was originally intended. What Obi-Wan was supposed to be doing and everything that's going on.
Let's just frame it as let's just say episodes 1 through 6 as they stand are canon. Looking at just those. looking at just
not what
those,
may have been intended.
Not what may have been intended. You've got the whole extended universe of comic books, novels, video games.
Yeah, I don't read any of that. They can change any of that.
I mean, that changes the whole landscape. Let's not look at any of that. Let's just focus on the film. I'm not even talking about the novelizations of the film because those changed considerable things. But what happens through the course of that is that we see the connection being remade. That everybody becomes aware. The light has been shined. Vader realizes through the course of this that his children are not dead, or at least he only really knew that she was pregnant. I don't even know that he knew that there were twins.
That they were alive.
Yeah, or that they were alive, or that more than one of them lived. He realizes that Luke is his son, and it's only through Episode 6 that he comes to realize that the sister is alive also. It made for some very awkward moments in retrospect when they had a kiss. Even though that was never really romantic. It was never really romantic. It was her ploy to throw it back in Han Solo's face.
Oh yeah, in Empire Strikes Back.
And it was, I mean, it was, that's who she wanted.
It was largely innocent, that kiss. I mean, it was just there isn't much, I don't think there's much perversion in the story at all.
No. Now, getting through the story, I'm not going to get into too much more detail. Flashing forward through a lot of extraneous stuff that's really not important to the story at this point, we see a final conflict with Luke and Vader and the Emperor. And this is the point when Luke makes an appeal to his father, talks to him, and touches him. He gets through. He gets through to him. And at that point, Vader realizes that he's been misled. Everything's laid out before him. And his eyes have been opened. And he's been duped. So he turns it back around on the Emperor when the Emperor directly attacks his child. There's nothing like the feeling of your child being attacked. And that's when everything kicks in.
Right.
And that's when he goes after the Emperor.
An interesting comical thing to me is a buddy of mine and my brother were talking about that scene, you know, where Vader, he's just got the mask. And the mask has no emotional, you know, countenance, you know, at all.
Right.
It's just the same. It's just the same face all the time. But you see him go back and forth and look at Luke and then look at the Emperor. And my brother and my buddy were like, hey, you can actually feel him like you think his face is changing, or you think about it in terms of, you know, the story pulls you in and like you can feel him thinking and like figuring it out, and like, you know,
it was a great bit of acting through a mask.
Yeah,
it was a really great bit of acting. So the ultimate resolution is that the Emperor is destroyed. Through the course of it, Vader dies. We get to pull off his mask, and Vader gets to look upon his son for the first time.
Right.
Okay. Happy dance with the Ewoks.
Yeah.
The end. Now, a couple things to note about the specifics of the movies. One, and we'll get into this more next week with the further discussion of Lucas. Star Wars is Episode 4, A New Hope, is an extreme product of its time. The pacing of that movie is so slow compared to movies today. Watch Episodes 1 through 6 back to back to back. Episode 3 is frenetic at the end. It is just insane the speed it is moving. Things are happening very fast, almost to the point where you feel like it should slow down a little bit. Especially through the Jedi slaughtering sequences, the Order, I believe it's Order 66, that where the stormtroopers are turning on all the Jedi, and they're all getting slaughtered. Everything is moving at light speed, just rapid fire. And, you know, you get everything moving toward the end. It ends. If you watch episode 4 right after that, you've been running just a mile a minute. You're running NASCAR. And when you get to episode 4, you're walking.
But
it is an extreme change of pace. Granted, it's a product of the time. Movies that were made in the 70s were not that fast.
I actually think that's one of
but I mean
episode 4's great strengths. Ultimately, I think Return of the Jedi.
Well, you
also
have,
moves in a frenetic pace similar to 3. I think that the 3 episodes are parallel to one another.
Oh, absolutely.
One and 4 are very much alike, and 2 and 5, and then 3 and 6.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've got, I mean, right now we've got a generation that doesn't pay attention.
Right.
We have to constantly throw images at people. You know, I know people that can't watch commercials, not because they have a DVR and fast forward through them. When they see a commercial, they're flipping channels. You know, I'm not being entertained
right
now. I have to move on to something that will entertain me, and not something that's just trying to sell me something. It's a product of its time. Even episode 1 is a much faster paced motion picture than episode 4 is.
I don't know if that's true. And here's why. Because Lucas filmed episode 4 from the point of view of the droids going into this world. And he says he got that idea from Kurosawa's film, The Hidden Fortress.
Okay.
In which two regular villagers get in the middle of this war and they don't know what's going on. Now, we understand that is not necessarily the case with the droids. They've been a part of this story the whole time, but
they've had their memory wiped.
Right. So, from our perspective, they're going in, you know, numb. In episode 1, you follow pretty much the same formula in that you're following a young Obi-Wan, Liam Neeson, who is a senior Jedi, but only a knight. He's not a master. And you're following the unknowing, witless Jar Jar Binks.
Mm-hmm.
And they go through a similar storyline. They are thrust into conflicts they do not fully understand because they're not aware of the fact... Well, Jar Jar Binks isn't aware of much of anything, but the Jedi are not aware of the fact that a Sith is pulling the strings behind this trade war, and they're floating through this submarine, and they get in all kinds of humorous entanglements.
Sure,
it's
sure.
Very much the same pace of the first film.
But you're also talking about one solid storyline and 4 storylines. Now let me just make this point that will kind of cement a little more what I'm speaking of. And I really got this reading the novels, but and I said that I'm not going to use the novels as an example, but I picked up on this through reading the novels. When you read at a slower pace than you watch a movie,
right?
You know, you can more easily see trends as you're reading than you can watching the film. And what I really noticed was episode 1 has, especially at the end, the last act, you have one sequence. You have the light or the sequence of going through the tunnel. You're going toward the Death Star. You're going through the tunnel at the Death Star. Out of nowhere, the Millennium Falcon shows up. We never see Han Solo's story. We never see him from the point of leaving the Rebel base until he just shows up, which is great. I mean, we don't need to see that. It makes for a more exciting moment in the film. But we have one story. Now, episode 5. Now I'm going to go back and talk about movies in the order they were shot. So the way the first one was shot, we had one story. The second one was shot, we have two stories in the last act. We have Luke coming to Bespin, and we have Leia and the droids and Chewbacca and, you know, the Hansicle in two different stories.
I think we have that in 4-2. I think you have Luke and Han Solo and crew, and you have Obi-Wan's story with Darth Vader, which is completely different.
No, I'm only talking about the last act. I'm only talking about the last act.
Okay.
The end of the film. when all the action is taking place, when all the conflict is taking place, there's only one point of conflict in episode four.
Okay.
Episode two, there's two.
There's 2 points of conflict.
There's 2 points of conflict. By the time you get to episode six,
there are three. Battle on land, star battle, and the Luke Vader battle.
Absolutely. Okay. Go to episode one, there are four.
Okay, what four are those?
Those are the battle with Jar Jar's people against the Trade Federation droids.
Okay.
You've got the battle that Padme and her guard are going through, fighting through the palace. You've got young Anakin in the starship flying around.
Okay.
And you've got
Obi-Wan
and Qui-Gon against Darth Maul. You've got four different stories running.
Okay.
So in the last act especially, your pace is just ratcheted up completely different.
And okay, I would have to agree with that.
Okay, I mean, that's the way it happened. There's you have to agree.
Yeah.
But I think Star Wars is an interesting product of its times, as you see the films being shot. And I think even in that case, to take a look at these six movies made in two different generations, you can really tell the differences in filmmaking, not in special effects. I'm not talking special effects. I'm not talking anything other than just storytelling styles. They are different.
They are different.
They are different. Now, granted, you know, when you come to episodes 5 and 6, you got different directors, you have more help writing. Episodes 1 through 3, all George.
Yeah.
All George, all the time.
But I think that ultimately...
And which is unfortunate for dialogue.
Well, I don't know if it's true. I would have to say... Here's my thing.
Did you honestly believe the love story between Anakin and...
No,
and Padme?
But that is absolutely the worst episode of the six. I mean, and the other thing is that those are not strong protagonists in terms of the characters as being acted by the actors. I think that.
But how much of their acting was directed by the director?
Well, here's the thing. This is probably the
most...
Because
I've seen Natalie Portman in other things, and she is better than
that's true, but some people need to be directed, and some people can carry a film just with their presence.
Right.
And this is what I think is the interesting part about... And this is going to be the most contentious part.
All right.
You know, about, as far as Phantom Menace...
Ready for the SmackDown?
All right, yeah, the fanboy SmackDown. I think the strongest episodes, in all four of which I think are pretty much really, really good, are 4, 5, 1, and 3. And they are buoyed by strong senior performances by Liam Neeson, Ian McDiarmid as the Emperor,
mm-hmm.
Alec Guinness as the older Obi-Wan in 4,
yes.
And then Harrison Ford as a major character in episode 5. I think those are the reason those stories are so strong, because the characters driving them are very strong characters. And I think that Lucas perhaps may have lost his touch with episode 2, but I would argue that episode 6, which he did not direct, is not incredibly strong either. I think it's weak. I think a lot of the dialogue is kitschy. I really don't buy a lot of it. I think it's very... Outside of the conversation between McDiarmid and Luke at the end,
right.
Which again is McDiarmid,
sure.
I think that it ultimately suffers as a very, very weak
now,
film.
Now, granted, it's also him, 18, 20 years earlier?
Yeah.
I mean, he, his acting is going to improve.
Right.
Yeah, and it's very interesting seeing an actor playing someone older even though they were younger.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Now, something else I want to bring up, because this is a point of contention in fandom. One character that I want to talk about, in specifically, Jar Jar Binks.
Okay.
Okay. I will make the contention that I think Jar Jar Binks was completely appropriate, that he served a purpose, served it well, and is completely appropriate for where he's at. You've got a character that is comic relief, which, okay, you know, Chewbacca was in comic relief in points of, in quite a bit of points in episodes 4 and 5. C-3PO was very much comic relief.
The Laurel and Hardy thing between him and R2-D2 is
absolutely
the key to full. Yeah, I don't have a problem. I never had a problem with Jar Jar Binks. I mean, I don't think I necessarily thought, wow, what a great character. But I didn't care.
You know what? It's a character for children.
Yeah.
And you know what? And you know, this is where I hope we get some voicemail from the show. You know, our voicemail number, 206-339-3273. That's FBSD Fanboy Smackdown. Feel free to give us a call and let us know what you think.
This will get some fan mail back.
I hope so, because what I would like to point out is that, you know what, Jar Jar Binks' point was it was a marketable character, it was a character for kids. Star Wars were kids' movies. All 5 of the 6 movies were children's movies. Episode 3 is much darker. I think you have to
say
have
5 is also as dark.
Five is pretty dark.
5 is pretty bad in terms of, and I think it's both on a psychological level. I think 3 was rated higher because of the more violence, but on a psychological level, watching five as a kid would be pretty difficult.
I mean,
and the limb count.
Does George Lucas have something against hands?
Well,
how many people have lost hands in these movies? I haven't done a study, but I think we should do a hand count.
I think it's just easy in an archetypical story to create as a physical manifestation of the grotesqueness of a character's psychological weakness by, you know, creating an amputation in conflict. I just think that it's just the most basic way you can do it. It's effective. And in an archetypical story, to go any deeper than that would be far too difficult in the size of the story you have to tell and the amount of time you have to tell it.
Good. Now, I want to make one more point. We're running a little bit long for what we thought, but that's okay. This is our first time. We're still getting into this. And
we'll do an hour. Who cares?
We don't have any feedback yet.
Right.
Nobody can call and leave us a voicemail until we put something out there.
Right.
Merchandising. You know, it's long been a fan bitch that merchandising has driven Star Wars.
I'll tell you what,
you know what though? Any point that can be made about the merchandising for episodes 1 through 3 can also be made for 4 through 6.
Sure.
We've got, you know, what the hell point were the bounty hunters in episode 5? You showed us 5 bounty hunters, of which only one did anything other than just stand there and look cool. Unless you count how many of them had action figures. All of them. You had 5 or 6 characters that had a sum total of 30 seconds, generously, of screen time. And these were all action figures. And you know what?
You're not going to find any argument from me.
I was 12 years old. I had every damn one of them. To say that all the different merchandising that was done for these other 3 movies did the same thing. It's always been done. Movies are a business.
Well, here's the thing. I think
these are not art house films. They were not made to garner Oscars. You know, which there are really 2 reasons to make movies in Hollywood. One is to get an award, and one is to make money. But
I think the power of the merchandising. And I'm a capitalist, and I'm all for all the merchandising you want to do, you can do. But I think the reason Lucas's merchandising is both honorable and effective is because he is the only true independent filmmaker on the scale of him that
yeah,
exists.
Absolutely.
I mean, he built the entire empire himself. All the special effects are in-house. All of the characters he created. Every cent and dime goes to him because he created it all, and you can't say that there's anything wrong with that. Some studio isn't, you know, mutating your personal vision into a marketing ploy. I mean,
right.
he's using the merchandising to fund Lucasfilm.
Sure.
Is there anything wrong with that? He has more power, more individual power in the film industry than anyone I can think of. He doesn't have to answer to anybody, and thank God for that. I mean, well, it's refreshing to see someone to make it outside of the, quote, system.
Right.
Which is why Scorsese's films continue to get trimmed, because as good as a director he is, he doesn't know anything about money, and he can't ultimately, you know, make any judgments about how he wants his films to be done.
Sure, and, you know, I think with George Lucas is... I think George Lucas is an incredible storyteller. He really has a knack for telling stories. I would argue that he works best when he works with other people. The best film he made in the Star Wars, arguably the best film that was in the Star Wars, it's not my personal favorite, but Empire Strikes Back is often argued as the best Star Wars film. And he didn't direct it. He didn't write. He didn't have the final screenplay on it.
But you know,
you know, it's filmmaking is a collaborative effort. You have to let loose the reins. A writer has to have a place in the system. A director has to have a place in the system. Actors have to have a place in the system.
It's easy to say, that because he didn't direct.
If you're not careful, and there are some that pull it off magically, you have writer directors that really work. You have writer director actors that that work. Not always the case. It doesn't always work. And I think George Lucas, as a storyteller, as a producer, does a phenomenal job. As a director, I think with a good script, he's got a good eye. He's got a great eye with a good script.
I think the weakness is in his writing, not his directing.
I think so. I'll take it all the way back to his dialogue. I don't think it's his writing in general. I think his stories are good. If you take a look at the story of episodes 1 through 6, it is a good, solid story, straight through. I'm not talking about the films. I'm talking about just the relaying of the story we just did.
I don't know who wrote the script for 5, but I think that 5 is the strongest film because of the revelation that Luke has at the end. That's the reason it's the strongest film. I mean, you can't argue that all of the silly, I feel like I could take the Empire on myself, beginning in that ice battle. My gosh, that stuff makes me want to vomit, man. I can't stand listening to that dialogue.
Really?
Oh, it's so retarded. No, I don't believe any of it. I think the only reason 5 exists as the strongest film is because of the impact the revelation had on audiences at the time of its release. I think if they were filmed sequentially now, 1 through 6, in that order chronologically, 5 would not be the strongest film.
No.
3 would be the strongest film.
Yes.
Because...
Absolutely. You're absolutely right.
Because the revelation is, oh my gosh, he's not the one. If that was the way it was going to go down originally.
Yep.
I think that Lucas is a good director.
Wait a minute. What do you mean by he's not the one?
If you're watching 1 through 3 and you haven't seen 4 through 6...
Right.
All of the prophecy says he's the one, he's the one, he's the one.
He is the one. He is the one that brings balance to the Force. If you look at it, the Jedi were
I would say here's the
okay,
thing.
here's where the smackdown comes in. Okay.
The prophecy is that one will bring balance to the Force, okay?
Right.
But what does balance to the Force mean? Balance to the Force in terms of what they're talking about, the prophecy was the destruction of the Sith. It was not good and evil balanced. I don't think that's
now,
necessarily
no, that's not Now, that might be what the Jedi thought it meant.
Well, here's...
I think that's what the Jedi thought it meant. Now, you can also argue that the Jedi were corrupt. At the point where they were in episodes 1 through 3, the Jedi had overstepped their bounds. They had become more than their even probably their self-imposed mandate would hold. They were controlling the Senate as much as possible. And... you bring balance to anything. I read a lot of fantasy.
I just don't see that much.
Fantasy prophecy, which is definitely where Lucas was pulling this from. It's a hook in fantasy, is that you have a prophecy, and the prophecy will drive the story. And the interpretation of the prophecy is always the hook at the end. It's like a mystery novel. But you have somebody's dead. The prophecy is the body. And the interpretation of the prophecy is finding out who the killer is understanding what those words mean. And then the big revelation at the end is,
if the story here's the meaning. If the story was not as archetypical as it is, I might agree with you. But I think in terms of how the story is told, I don't believe there's any reason to believe that the Jedi are a corrupt body. I think that the gag is on the Jedi is they believe that because this boy had no father, Anakin, mm-hmm. that he was the one and he had the strongest count. But you find out in episode 3 that he was created by a sinister Sith. And the great irony of the prophecy is that the son of this creation is actually the one, Luke Skywalker, who brings balance to the Force. And that's something that the Sith did not plan on either.
But does Luke really bring balance? Where
he destroys the Sith.
But is that balance? Is that the balance? Is that the evening of the scale? My argument is that the acts of Anakin Skywalker and Palpatine at the end of Episode 3, Order 66, and Anakin's slaughtering of the Jedi is balanced. It's evening the scales. The Sith...
No, it's
there
not.
Were two, there were two Sith.
But there's always there only two Sith.
Okay. And at the end of Episode 3, there are only two Jedi. That is balance. There are two.
Yeah, but they're... But
balance. There's... Even the scales. Balance.
Yeah, but I mean...
Okay.
If you're talking in terms of absolute numbers, but the Sith was retaining more power. I think balance is talking about harmony in terms of a...
You know what? This is the argument.
Okay.
Everybody's got their own take on it. Let's hear it from somebody else, okay? 206-339 FBSD Fanboy Smackdown. That's 206-339-3273. Let us know what you think. FanboySmackdown@gmail.com. Send us an email. Send us a voicemail. Let us know. We are interested in what you have to say.
Put it in the hands of the
You know what? Everybody's got their own take on it.
That's right.
Read a message board. They're all going to bitch about it. Let's hear what you got to say.
I want to get back to the part about, you know, I don't feel that, you know, in the hands of Lucas, the last three went wrong. I don't feel that way at all. I think two was horrible, but... I mean, I also think six was horrible, too. I mean, I don't really, you know...
Two was horrible, and three could have been done better. If you want my take on it, what they should have done was they should have cut about half of two out, cut out all the extraneous crap.
Two should have been three.
And two, they should have taken the first third of episode three, put it at the end of episode two.
Right, and then three should have been more.
Let three play out the way it should have. Let three play out the way it should have. I would have had no problem... with episode two, at some point, maybe an hour into episode two, saying 2 years later.
Right.
You know, begin the Clone Wars, have a montage of battle sequences of the Clone Wars, you know, 5-minute montage. Hey, 5-minute montage of battle sequences, who's not going to geek out over seeing Jedi and clone troopers and everybody
right.
else going toe-to-toe? Let's see some battles. Then... just pick it up 2 years later for the last hour of the film.
I agree.
And then, you know, let episode three really play out and let us see what happens.
Ultimately, by not going awry in three in terms of the way the story is told, at least it met my expectations. And by doing that, Lucas has pulled off a remarkable success because
right.
I think it's safe to say that everybody's expectations were too great. I went to see Phantom Menace 4 times. I was very impressed with it. I could not believe how well done it was.
Right.
When I read the reviews and how everybody hated it, I thought they were on another planet because it was kind of the ultimate Star Wars film. At that point, I mean, how could you not like it? I understand what everyone had their preconceptions, what they thought it could be, but how could you not like it? The Liam Neeson was a very strong protagonist in the film, and
you know, it was
very effective.
The problem with Star Wars is people saw episodes 4 through 6 when they were kids,
right?
And they've built it up onto a new level. You know, there's music that you listen to at the age of 12 that out of nostalgia you would
love
still
it.
Listen to,
right?
If you listen, if that music came on the air, on the radio today as new music, you'd be like, what the hell is this crap? And you'd turn the station. You know, and anybody that says otherwise, listen to the 80s music.
I mean, it's, a lot of it's really bad.
It's cheesy, it's goofy.
Except for Springsteen, everybody. That's right.
I love it. I love the 80s music. I was there for all of it. The problem with Star Wars is people saw 4 through 6 when they were kids. You know, in whatever incarnation, whether they saw them new in the theater, whether they saw them on HBO, whether they saw them on VHS.
Yeah, 4 was the first movie I ever saw as a kid.
There you go.
Period.
There you go. Now, the fact is that these are kids' movies. You enjoyed them as children. There's a lot of it that still works for adults. But episodes 1 through 3 are kids' movies. They're not. You know, it's one thing to watch episode 4 as a 9-year-old. It's a completely different thing to watch it as a 35-year-old. It's completely different.
I think
it's a completely different set of experiences, and you're bringing different things to it.
And the reason
I couldn't understand why my parents didn't love this film. This is great.
Right.
I didn't get it.
And I think the reason that the second trilogy works is 3 effectively completes the story well.
Yes.
You don't feel like you're being cheated at all. Maybe it wasn't the way you liked it, but you have to admit that it was put together well. It's effective in its storytelling. Ian McDiarmid is just the centerpiece of the film. He does a great job at being, I guess, devilish in his enticement. It was very effective, I thought.
Okay.
One, if you hated 1, you're not seeing it in the perspective that it should be seen. If you're an adult, if you're watching the film, it is entirely about the wonderment of young Anakin Skywalker at this world that he's entering into.
Absolutely.
And if you are a kid and you're watching the film, and the film is visually stunning, I think it's still one of the most amazing films I've ever seen in the theaters in terms of
the
just
pod
watching
racing,
it.
The pod racing scene alone is worth price.
Oh, it's fantastic. And if you put yourself in a kid's shoes, that is one of the best films in the entire sextet, I think.
Yep.
And that's pretty much all I wanted to say.
Okay, one last point, then we'll go ahead and call this done. Any point in any of the films, if you could change one thing to any point in the movies, what would it be?
I think it would definitely be the love story between Anakin and Padme and how it evolved in 2.
You know what? I'd say the same thing. The difference, the only thing that, you know, if my name suddenly changed to George Lucas, the only thing I would do different is in episode 3, because, okay, we have a very powerful Jedi in Anakin Skywalker. One of the Jedi's known powers is manipulation of the Force, manipulation of minds. What's to say? I mean, you watch episode 2 and 3, especially 2, he was a stalker. He had a very stalkeristic, the way he looked
at her,
the
kid.
Way he followed. He was a kid.
And that the
Let me finish. As an adult looking at it, you'd look at it as a stalker. As a teenager looking at it, it's kind of a teenager's, you know, way of doing things. But just the force of his will of wanting her. What's to say his Jedi powers weren't influencing her? I thought that would have been an incredible hook, is that in the end she didn't really love him.
I think that would have been interesting.
It was a manipulation of her mind.
It would have made 2 a lot better.
It would have made 2
so unbelievable.
It would have made 2 make a whole lot more sense.
Yeah, well,
so, you know, if I could change anything,
I think the whole point is that
I don't want to change anything.
Anakin's love for her is supposed to be pure. And how that pure love is twisted into a dark, twisted version of itself.
Absolutely.
That's the perversion. If it was always impure, I don't think you would believe that Anakin was basically a decent person.
Right.
And worth redeeming.
Right. But even that would be something that he had no control over. I don't know about that. The way I would write it.
Okay. I think with the Padme Anakin thing, I think the big weakness is in terms of how the love story was told, is that if he was as young and brash and and immature, as he was supposed to be in 2. There's no way a mature senator would ever fall in love with him. I just don't see that as being the case.
Right.
I think either he had to be more mature or she had to be more immature. And I understand what Lucas was trying to do, but it just didn't work. And that was my problem with it.
All right. If you guys have any
I have one more question before we...
All right, one more. Let's
just for contentious and for the feedback, you have to rank all 6. And then I have to, and then we'll call it a day.
With no explanation of why I'm ranking the way I do.
Yes.
From worst to least.
I think it would be interesting for feedback.
All right. With no explanation why, and if we get some feedback, I'll give a little more.
Right.
I'll give a little more.
We can expose out. Yeah.
Okay. In terms of individual films, as they stand alone.
Right.
Not in the sequence of the story. If I were to watch any one film without the context of the rest of the story, worst to best, episode 2.
Okay.
Episode 5. Episode 6. Episode 1. Episode 4. Episode 3.
Wow. All right.
And the 4 and 3, I'm a little iffy on, because as a standalone film, I take it back. I'm going to change 3 and 4. So my top 2, number 2, episode 3, number 1, episode 4. As a standalone film, it's the one that works best as a standalone piece. Nothing before it, nothing after it.
Very interesting.
My ranking.
All right. It's going from worst to best. Is what
worst to best.
2, right. 6.
Okay.
3.
Okay.
5, 1, 4.
Okay. All right. Good deal. Okay, we're going to call this done. If you guys have any more feedback, please let us know. FanboySmackdown@gmail.com or 206-339-FBSD, FanboySmackdown. That's 206-339-3273.
Do we have an email address for just text if they just want to write and not leave their
voice?
That
would be fanboysmackdown@gmail.com.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry.
All right.
I was thinking about the last questions.
Okay, let's listen to this, and we'll wrap this thing up.